You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to episode 12 of Commentary Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And today is part three in our look at Nicholas Meyer as a novelist, and we are going to be covering his second novel, The 7% Solution. And we're joined by a very special guest, John Tenuto. How's it going, John?
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
So now, John, I have to admit, I've kind of been, I guess you could say, stalking you for a few months now. I first saw you at a Star Trek convention in Chicago, about a year ago?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and you were giving a presentation on, I guess it would be like deleted scenes from Nicholas Meyer's movies. Is that accurate?
Yeah, they were... They were based on the early drafts of Nicholas Meyer's scripts for Star Trek's 2, 4, and 6. And so what the presentation did was it sort of looked at what these scenes were. They were scenes that were written and in most cases never filmed.
Yeah, and it was really interesting. You know, I enjoyed the presentation quite a bit. And then I kept on seeing your name pop up online in strange places like... on Trek Movie, you know, and stuff like that. And then I saw you on Twitter. I started following you. And then when, you know, Nicholas Meyer came around, I was like, oh, man, I want to talk to that dude. So thank you very much for doing this.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, so today's movie, or it's not a movie, it's a book. Sorry. Today's book is The 7% Solution. Which is a Sherlock Holmes mystery. So just to give sort of a brief synopsis of what the movie is about, it takes place...
Movie? You said movie again.
Book. Sorry. I need to rewire my...
Movies?
Mm-hmm. It's a story which... It's not canon in the traditional Arthur Conan Doyle sense. In fact, it deliberately throws out certain stories in order to make it work. The basic premise of it is, you know, this is what would happen if Sherlock Holmes were to meet Sigmund Freud. And the way that they get into that story is through Sherlock Holmes's heroin addiction.
You know, cocaine.
It's cocaine, I guess, cocaine. Right? Okay. Yeah. Through his cocaine addiction, you know, Watson essentially tricks him into going to Austria.
Always a good way to get someone off drugs. Tricking them into a rehab program.
Yes. To get treated by mm-hmm. Sigmund Freud.
Yeah.
And through the course of that, you know, a mystery develops. So John, what are your thoughts on the book on the whole?
One of the things that I like about it is it's kind of an example of fanon or fan fiction, but done obviously on a professional level, a published level. But it really is kind of what the book is. Kind of an example of what Henry Jenkins called, you know, textual poaching or fan fiction, where a fan, which Meyer is a fan of, a huge fan of Sherlock Holmes, goes in and almost corrects problems that they see with, canon. So, you know, we're familiar with that in the world of Star Trek with people taking stories or characters they don't like. Somebody doesn't like that Data died in a movie, or they don't like that way Captain Kirk dies in Generations, so they rewrite it in fan fiction. And in a way, that's what this is, but of course on a much more professional and interesting level, where what Meyer did was he went back and he said, well, what can explain this, that what they call in the Sherlock Holmes fan world, the great hiatus, you know, this period of time that Holmes is sort of missing after his supposed death in a story called The Final Problem, where Moriarty and him go over the falls together. So he's gone for like 3 years, and then he comes back, and so he didn't die. And this book is really an attempt to kind of say, well, what really happened? Because that really wasn't what happened. He didn't die. There was no fight. Moriarty was actually never a villain. This story kind of goes in and picks at that kind of history a little bit, and in doing so, really sort of in a way starts the whole Sherlock Holmes pastiche that we're used to now, where people put Sherlock Holmes with other people, or, you know, kind of mess with the canon a little bit for Sherlock Holmes. So I think it's a great example of that kind of writing, probably one of the best examples of that kind of writing, and then also, you know, has that little connection to Star Trek that way.
That actually reminds me, like, you know, like Mike, I've talked with Mike about this in the past, but I've got a lot of problems with the original series of Star Trek. And one of my tactics for dealing with the problems of that show is to say that it's fiction in the world of Star Trek, which is essentially the same tool that Meyer uses in The 7% Solution by saying, there are a lot of stories that don't work, and I'm going to say that Watson made them up, but the other ones happened. And it's a very interesting approach. It's a way of making it more real by admitting that some of it is fake.
As far as this fitting into, you know, Holmes canon, I mean, obviously it does contradict stuff which is considered to be part of the canon, but, you know, I'm not really familiar with, you know, the works which have been done by other people aside from Meyer. I don't know if you guys know this, but how would you say this is regarded in relation to the other expanded Holmes fiction? I mean, I imagine it's probably at the top of the list, right?
Yeah, I mean, this was such a monster hit. I mean, it was on the New York Times bestseller list for 40 weeks or so, and I think it was the ninth bestseller that year. I mean, that year had Jaws and Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. I mean, there were huge books that year, and the book sold really, really well. And I think because it sounds so authentic, it really sounds like it was written as part of those original set of stories, in a way that nobody had done up till that point, and I don't know really that anybody has been able to do since that. I mean, in a way, it took a fan to write like that. You know, you needed somebody who was as knowledgeable about Sherlock Holmes as Nicholas Meyer is to write that, and then, of course, then you need additional qualities like being a good storyteller and so on, and he has all of that. So he was sort of the perfect person, I think, to do this book. It was, you know, and he was, I mean, when you look at the new show that they have on, I think it's on CBS now, I mean, that's taking the character pretty far afield.
There are two Sherlock Holmes shows currently running. There's the BBC's Sherlock, and there's CBS's Elementary. Sherlock does it really well. Elementary doesn't do it so bad.
Well, it's, you know, it's the typical problem of updating something that maybe doesn't need to be updated.
Yeah, well, I think Sherlock works really well. Have you watched Sherlock?
Mm-hmm, sure. Oh, yeah, definitely. Have to, you know, it's a good place to see Cumberbatch in action before he's in action somewhere else this summer.
You were talking about how Meyer does a good job of sort of capturing the spirit of Holmes, and I find that to be really interesting because I really did feel like it. He found Doyle's voice. You know, he did a good job of mimicking that style. And you know, if you look at his first book, Target Practice, which we covered last episode, he does a very similar type of story. You know, they're both detective fiction, but different types of detective fiction. And whereas Target Practice is super modern, both in terms of the story and then also in terms of the style of writing, you know, this he goes in a complete opposite direction. And I was really impressed by his ability to adapt to the different subgenre.
Yeah, I think he's great at that. I mean, he does. I mean, if you look at his whole career, both as a writer and a director, but especially as a writer, you know, he's had to do that a bunch of times. He's had to kind of come into something that pre-exists and has its own voice, and then he has to come in and, you know, make it something maybe, you know, different, modern, tell a new story in there, but keep it within that world. So, like, when I think what he used to say about Star Trek is really true of Sherlock Holmes, too. I mean, that he used to compare Star Trek to the Catholic Mass, where there's certain things that are set the same every week. You know, in the Catholic Church, the sort of the steps of the service are the same. What changes is the music, the readings, the message that week. But then there's certain things that are sort of set in stone, and that's the way it is when he came in with Star Trek. I mean, you had the actor set, you had the Enterprise. There were certain things that you have to keep the same. And then around that, you generate something that's new and interesting. And I think he did that with this book, too. He took the contrivances and the heart of Sherlock Holmes, and then built something new around it, which was this idea of having, you know, Holmes and Freud, you know, on an adventure together, which is just great because, you know, in many ways, Sherlock Holmes as a detective and Freud as a psychoanalyst really are doing the same thing. They're both sort of solving mysteries based on clues and, you know, whether those clues are footprints or symptoms of a patient, they're both really doing the same thing. And it was a great idea to kind of put those two worlds together like that, but then keep it, you know, in the voice of the originals, so that it feels like it belongs to that world.
All right. So, in terms of like looking at this in Meyer's career on the whole, you know, he wrote this, or the book came out in 1974 when Meyer was only 29 years old. It came out actually just 3 months after Target Practice. So he had, you know, two, you know, one right after the other. And this was obviously much more well-received than Target Practice. It became a huge hit, like you were saying. But yeah, we talked about how, you know, both of them were detective fiction, but, you know, different types of detective fiction. I find that interesting that there's a lot of similarities in terms of, like, themes and also devices, which are present in both Target Practice and 7% Solution. You know, obviously they're both detective books, but then they're also kind of set against the backdrop of war. They both have like a pretty heavy psychological component.
So you're saying Target Practice, 7% Solution, and Star Trek VI have a lot of things in common?
I mean, I guess so, and Star Trek VI too. Sure, yeah. And then there's there's even a drug addiction subplot in Target Practice, but yeah, I find that interesting. That, I mean, these are obviously things which seem to be interesting to him. You know, in particular, the psychology aspect, I think, is interesting.
If I know the history right, I think Target Practice was written after this, but came out before. The reason Target Practice came out first was because I believe there was a long gestation period of trying to get the rights, you know, to use, they could use Freud because he was dead, but they couldn't use, you know, Doyle as a licensed character, so they needed to get permissions and you know, whatever deals needed to be struck, and I think he was sort of like, you know, waiting around for the book to come out and wrote that other book, wrote Target Practice, but that wound up coming out first because it was a totally original storyline, you know. And then, of course, the psychology part of that, of a lot of his works, I think, you know, would stem from his father. I would believe him. His father was a psychiatrist.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that his dad was a psychiatrist, but that makes a lot more sense now. Okay, so this book actually had two sequels, one which came out just a couple years later called The West End Horror, and then another one in 1993 called The Canary Trainer. Have you read either of those, John?
I did, a long time ago. Actually, when Canary Trainer came out, I read that. And West End Horror I read after that, believe it or not.
Well, it actually takes place after that, right?
The Canary Trainer, if my memory serves, is a lot more of a sequel to The 7% Solution, whereas The West End Horror is like an adventure. If my memory is right, it's more like a separate adventure, another Holmes tale, where Canary Trainer, I think, might be a little more connected to that. Although in West End Horror, I think he meets a bunch of people, too. It isn't as dramatically important as meeting Sigmund Freud is in this book, though.
Well, that is a thing that he does. I mean, he seems to do that even in 7% Solution. Like, aside from Sigmund Freud, there's a number of characters, both fictional and non-fictional, which he crosses paths with. And at times it seems a little bit cheesy. I don't know. I mean, it seems to be a thing that Meyer likes to do. I mean, he also does that in Time After Time, of course.
Well, in Time After Time, that's sort of the whole movie.
Well, yeah, I know. I mean, it's very similar to this and that. But, I mean, like, that seems to be, like, a thing.
It does seem like he was like, oh, I really like doing that. That's fun, having characters meet historical and fictional figures from various points. I know, I'll write a movie about that happening every scene.
What do you guys think about that choice in general?
Well, I think maybe now it's, in some ways, now it may be a little more passé. And in a way, it may be like, you know, we think of that as, oh, that's, you know, that's like the young Indiana Jones TV show where he bumps into every historical figure you know, of the era. I think, you know, now, you know, if we put ourselves back in that era, especially the Sigmund Freud and Sherlock Holmes kind of connection, it was kind of a fresh idea back then. I mean, the whole notion of sort of combining, you know, even just combining franchises, even within the same world. I mean, you didn't see, you know, too many Superman, Batman crossover, you know, I mean, that whole idea of doing crossovers like that really wasn't a big part of the consciousness. And I think, you know, this book and other popular culture items of that era where you have those types of crossovers, you know, now we're used to Alien, Predator, you know, those type of things. But I think the idea of mixing either real world people within these fictional stories or, you know, fictional characters crossing over into other fictional character adventures at the time of the 7% solution was a pretty new idea.
So the
thing?
Yeah.
The movie?
No, I'm sorry. The book. Well, no, I was going to talk about the movie, actually.
Okay.
The movie, he wrote the screenplay himself, and it was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. Now, I tried desperately to find a copy of this movie, and I couldn't. It's not on Netflix or anything like that, so I actually didn't get to see it. I think it's maybe out of print.
January 22nd, it's actually going to be out on Blu-ray, believe it or not.
Oh, all right. Sweet. Well, what do you guys think about the movie?
Yeah, I really like the film. There's a lot in there, you know, that I like. I just like certain things that are kind of fresh and different. The credits are fun because they're not only in the style of you would imagine the credits being if a film had been made back then, but they have like footnotes in the credits, which are great, you know, as you're watching. So you have to read the credit and there's a little footnote. What I think is fascinating is when he was writing the script for the film, he was ejecting things out of his book. Like he wanted to up the mystery a little bit more. And it was interesting because the director, Herbert Ross, would tell Meyer, "No, you need to put that back in. You know, you know, that's a great scene. People want that scene." And so, I think Meyer, being a relatively new screenwriter at that time, he had only written a few films before then. You know, he was finding his way as a screenplay author. And I think, you know, one of the things he criticizes himself for is, you know, he has a tendency, or had a tendency, at least when he first started writing, to do too much dialogue. And, you know, the film is heavy on dialogue, but it's good dialogue, and it's really interesting. I think the big problem for both the book and the movie is Watson, in a way, you know, Freud is Watson in the story. And you have two Watson. Yeah, so Watson, you know, he's important because he's the one that brings, you know, the cocaine-addicted Holmes to Freud. But in some ways, after that, he's not important to the mystery. It's more Freud, and the fun is Freud and Holmes. So, but it's wonderful to see their interactions in the movie. The film is really great. I'm so happy it's coming out on Blu-ray, because I hope a whole new audience of people can kind of get exposed to it, because it is a fun, you know, film. It's got some action adventure. It's, you know, and it's really well written, and it's a very good adaptation from book to film, I think.
So, seeing as how it was adapted by the guy who wrote the source material, you know, and that, you know, is a unique opportunity for a writer to go back and revise and you know, alter some of the things that he may not have thought he got right the first time around. Do you guys think that the book is superior or the movie?
I would say the movie. I mean, for lots of different reasons. But, I mean, I think that the tennis scene in the book, it doesn't make any sense. It's incomprehensible. Tennis is difficult to follow even when you're watching it.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Oh, I got a point. Now I'm up by 15.
What about you, John?
Well, I mean, it's you know, I think they're two different mediums. And in some ways, I think because it's so talky, it may work better as a book or a play, I guess. But of course, you know, the train chase and all of that. I mean, the film, they kind of upped Moriarty's, you know, the revelation. I don't want to spoil the book for anybody or the movie if people haven't seen it, but the revelation of really why Holmes is who he is, which comes at the very end of the book and the very end of the film. And, you know, Moriarty, maybe because he's played by Laurence Olivier, is a little more central to that. But, you know, I think for anybody getting into Holmes, this is actually a good place to start.
Yeah, it has a good origin story, which Holmes never really had.
Right. I mean, it really helps you understand who is this character. And this is a great place to start because it does give you, I think, a good picture of what whether you start with the book or the film version of it, and then go back and read. It helps you to kind of, you have a sort of a good face to put to those books and a voice to put to those original books and original short stories.
Okay, so now to tie this all back to Star Trek, I have one last little thing. There's, you know, a line in Star Trek VI, which I'm assuming was written by Meyer, I mean, and not his co-writer, where Spock says that one of his ancestors said that when you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however unlikely, is the truth, or something to that effect. That's obviously a Sherlock Holmes axiom. It's obviously something which Nicholas Meyer is very fond of. He brings it up in Target Practice, even. And the idea of him bringing it into Star Trek and applying it to Spock only makes sense. And you know, Spock being a Vulcan, that seems like a very Vulcan philosophy. But I have since heard speculation from fans, I'm assuming, that the intention may have been to say that Sherlock Holmes is actually one of Spock's ancestors on his human side. First off, have you guys heard that, and what do you guys think about it?
Of course I've heard about it, and Meyer brings it up on the commentary to Star Trek VI.
Does he?
Yes.
Okay. What do you think about it, John?
Well, yeah, I mean, that line is uttered by Holmes, I think, a few times, or derivations of it. I think it's in, like, the story, The Sign of the Four, and it's, you know, verbatim Star Trek VI, and then the new Spock says it again in Star Trek 2009. If you want to enjoy Star Trek II a little more, read Moby Dick. If you want to enjoy Star Trek VI a little more, read Sherlock Holmes, because I think, I mean, the whole mystery is a Sherlock Holmes mystery. Spock is Sherlock Holmes in that movie. That's his function. And the crew, you know, Chekhov is the Nigel Bruce bumbling version of Watson, and Valeris is the more Conan Doyle version of Watson, and so on. And I think the crew sort of serves as Watson, or at least the co-partner in Spock, as he kind of goes through and try to solve the mystery. So it makes sense to connect Spock with Sherlock Holmes, because he certainly writes, even in Four, there's the whole thing of, I don't guess, you know, which Meyer, of course, wrote Star Trek Four with Harve Bennett. And there's the whole I don't guess business, which is a big part of, you know, it's an insult to Sherlock Holmes if you say, you know, is that a guess? You know, of course it's not a guess. I base things on facts. I mean, so I think there's elements of Spock as Sherlock Holmes in all of Meyer's versions of Star Trek, but especially Star Trek VI. I mean, half the movie is a mystery.
What Mike is going for here is he wants you to say that Star Trek fits into Sherlock Holmes continuity.
Well, I mean, first off, I never really thought about Star Trek VI like that, and that does make a lot of sense. I'm going to have to watch it again now, looking at it as a Sherlock Holmes mystery. But yeah, that's fascinating. But yeah, no, I am curious. Like, do you think Star Trek fits into Sherlock Holmes continuity?
Yeah, I mean, certainly in the future, they're aware of Sherlock Holmes, right? You've got Data playing him, and there's a starship named the USS Sherlock Holmes in the conspiracy episode. And, you know, and Picard teaches, right? Data tells Data about Sherlock Holmes, I think.
Yeah, there's a problem with that, because they do actually talk about how Sherlock Holmes is a fictional character and Moriarty is a fictional character. Remember Ship in a Bottle? Moriarty comes back?
All right. But I mean, could that be also, you know, just a scenario where Sherlock Holmes existed like Sigmund Freud existed?
Yeah.
And you know, Doyle...
Hypertime.
Fictionalized.
Just drop hypertime in there. Makes it all make sense.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to believe...
But the other interpretation of the Spock scene is that his ancestor is Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, right?
Oh, yeah, that could be. Oh,
that's
wow.
What Meyer says.
But remember, Meyer always says, my interpretation and your interpretation is as valid as his, right? That's one of his big things, is he doesn't have any answers to these things that the audience's view on it is just as good as the people who wrote it and directed it and wrote it. So I mean, I think it's fair to say that it's possible that as if we want to make it real, you know, that he is related to Conan Doyle, and Spock was speaking of the writings of his ancestor.
You're much more logical about it than most Star Trek fans dealing with expanded universe continuity. And any final thoughts on the 7% solution, John?
Well, I'd encourage anybody who likes, certainly if you like Sherlock Holmes, if you haven't read it or haven't read it in a while, it's fun to read it again, and also great to read it and think of it in terms of Star Trek VI, I think, and connect those two together. It's kind of a fun, and the point you guys made is really, really true. I mean, target practice, 7% solution, Star Trek VI, thematically share a lot in common. So it's a great way to kind of put those three worlds together.
What about you, Max?
The book is really good. It's a really good example of a Sherlock Holmes story done by someone who isn't Conan Doyle. And considering there are a number of Sherlock Holmes stories done by Conan Doyle that are not good, it's impressive that somebody who wasn't him managed to do it well. But it also sort of seems logical that somebody who wasn't him wouldn't be blinded by his own personal biases and was able to recognize what was good in it and what was bad in it and excise the things that were bad. And I wish that Meyer had been a little bit more bold with his continuity revising logic, because it would have been really nice if at the beginning of Star Trek VI he just had a list of episodes that never happened. Like Doomsday Machine, never happened.
Yeah, I also enjoyed the book quite a bit. I was actually a lot more interested in the sort of first half intro, you know, the idea of getting Holmes off of cocaine. That I found that to be more interesting than the actual mystery, which I thought was a little weak. But
well, I remember watching it as a kid. I remember seeing the movie as a kid and thinking that it was like, oh, just another Sherlock Holmes movie.
Mm-hmm.
I watched it like just another Sherlock Holmes movie, and then when I picked up the book, I was like, oh, that book, that's the Sherlock Holmes movie that I saw when I was a kid, and I was reading it, and I was like, is this really about him getting off drugs? How much of this book is about him getting off drugs? And I was like, it's freaking like rehab. It's like the 12-step program, but in a novel, and it's Sherlock Holmes and Sigmund Freud, and seriously, this is the story?
Yeah.
It's totally insane.
Yeah, but really cool. John, where can people find you, or what have you got going on that people might be interested in?
Well, if anyone's interested, I'm going to be doing a series of talks in the Chicagoland area, more on the northern suburbs, but a bunch of library talks. Some of them are going to be about Star Trek collectibles. Some of them are going to be a really hopefully fun brand new talk that I've developed. I was able to get a permission of Paramount to go in and look at all the archives for the making of Space Seed.
Oh, wow.
Oh my God, dude. Okay, this is just me. I want to ask you a question. Are you making a book about this kind of thing anytime soon? Because I would love to have a reference of this. And, like, all of these things are really fascinating to me, but I can't do all that driving.
I would love to. I just got, thanks to Mr. Meyer's permission and the University of Iowa, I just got another 300 new photos that I don't think most people have ever seen before. We digitized them. We're going to be showing them this summer at the May convention that Creation Entertainment is doing in Chicago. And it's great. We've got photos of the Khan baby scene, which was a scene in Star Trek II where there was a little kid. It wasn't Khan's baby, but it was a Khan's people's baby, kind of to show that they were procreating, and the baby crawls next to the Genesis device as it goes off. a very dark sequence.
Wow.
It was never filmed. They tried to film it. It just didn't work as a scene, and we've got photos of that. We also have photos of Kirk and his son have a much bigger physical fight. And what I love about Meyer is this idea of his that art thrives on limitations. And I think Star Trek is about the best example of something that's wonderful that is always coming out of, you know, limited budgets, limited special effects, limited time frames.
Parsimony.
Yeah, all, you know, the sort of Roddenberry rules that you have to live by, all these limitations that make Star Trek fantastic. And so that's what drives a lot of the research that my wife and I do is this that idea of looking at the making of these things and how they were able to produce such really good things often without, you know, a whole lot of time, money, you know, whatever it was that they were limited on. And so the space seed research is fascinating because it's we've discovered a few things that people don't know about the character of Khan, how the character of Khan developed, and just some really great, we got behind the scenes photos and just some really great things, and we're going to be sharing those you know, in a series of talks. So if anybody's interested and wants to know kind of where they're at or whatever, they can just give me an email at the college. It's just Jay Tenuto, just my name, Jay Tenuto, T-E-N-U-T-O, at clcillinois.edu, and Illinois is spelled out, or they could just go to the College of Lake County website and find me there and email me through there, and I can send them a list of the libraries and everything that we're going to be talking to about Star Trek. So it should be fun.
And as always,
did Khan have the ability to change his accent and turn into a white guy?
Khan started out as a character who named Harold Erickson, among other names. One of the things we discovered through the research, only because we were able to put certain pieces of paper next to each other that have never been put next to each other before, was that Khan was changed into Khan because of the casting of Ricardo Montalban. It wasn't the other way around. So Montalban was cast to play the Harold Erickson Viking Aryan guy, and of course, they decided, great actor, let's change the background of this character and make him different. And that's where Khan was born out of. So really, Montalban had a big part in the crafting of the background of that character from the way it was originally going to be played out. In fact, the script, one of the versions of the script has changed the name Erickson in the script to Khan all the way through, because that was done so late. It was the casting director who kind of came up with the idea, for whatever reason, no one knows why, but thought of Montalban for this role when he wasn't what was described on the page, except that, of course, he's a great actor, had worked with Roddenberry before, one of Roddenberry's first science fiction pieces for TV, Roddenberry thought it was a great idea, but it necessitated changing the character. So if Cumberbatch is Khan, it's much more, I think, the initial design of the character, as Cary Wilbur and Gene Kuhn had envisioned the character, and then the changes that were made were really made for Ricardo Montalban, and in a way, you know, I can't think of anybody else playing that role. I mean, he's so phenomenal in it, and both in Space Seed and especially in Wrath of Khan. And so this is only an opinion, but if Cumberbatch is Khan, which is the rumor, it may be the wisest thing in the world, because continuity, no. The fans who really care about that kind of stuff, no, because you're changing something about the character. But you can't duplicate Montalban, so why try? And if you're not going to duplicate him, then go a different direction. And maybe the direction they went with was to go back to the original.
Hey, I like the idea that the timeline shift caused them to revert to an earlier draft. I think that's a really cool idea.
But, you know, I love Khan. I love the character of Khan. I love studying how he developed he's in a way, he's like Moriarty. You know, he's not in every story, but he's the villain against which all other Star Trek villains are measured. And I think that Star Trek II is obviously the benchmark upon which all Star Trek films are measured.
Sweet.
Awesome.
And you're also on Twitter, right?
I am on Twitter, too. It's just Jay Tenuto.
Cool. All right. Well, as always, you can find us, you can find our other show at commentarytrackstars.com. You can find us on Twitter at comtrackstars, or you can email us at comtrackstars@gmail.com. And, of course, this show's on trek.fm, where you can find numerous other cool shows and movies. Thank you very much for joining us, John. It's been really cool. And you're welcome back anytime you want.
Thanks, guys. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Well, next week we'll be back with the next Nicholas Meyer Sherlock Holmes novel, The West End Horror.